These revelations would soon have a painful, chilling effect on my relationships with reporters. On CNN's late edition for Sunday, July 17, 2005, John King, the guest host who had been CNN's chief White House correspondent for years, summed up the attitude of his colleagues in the briefing room. They were willing to vouch for me to a point because they had come to know me and my reputation, but they could not go too far without a public explanation of events from me. The reporter's attitude would prove hurtful, but understandable. It wasn't so much an indictment of me as of the administration I worked for. The implication was clear. If some of the highest-ranking officials of the Bush White House hadn't been forthright with the president's chief spokesman, how could anyone assume they were honest with the public? The White House had a serious credibility problem, and I was now going to take the heat for it. The impact of that Sunday conversation and the imminent Newsweek scoop was the equivalent of getting whacked upside the head with a 2x4. I never saw it coming, given Carl's personal assurances to me and the president, at least not until the final few days before it became public. And even then, I convinced myself not to believe the growing buzz in Washington because of the personal assurances I had received. The Monday briefing following Isikoff's jolting revelation was brutal. After the initial period of the leak episode, nearly 2 years earlier, I had used the line, "I'm not going to comment on an ongoing investigation." It would end the questioning quickly, but not this day, given what I had so confidently asserted at the outset in the fall of 2003. John Roberts of CBS made sure to point out that I had, in fact, commented while the investigation had been underway for nearly 2 weeks, and he wondered why the change. Roberts was right, and I knew it. Although I had cleared Rove initially before notice of any investigation, I had not cleared Libby at the vice president's request and the president's direction until after we were informed about it. NBC's David Gregory mockingly said it was ridiculous that I would not answer whether I stood by my previous assertions of no involvement by Rove, Libby, and Abrams, chiding me for unresponsively not saying anything about the Newsweek revelations. Then Terry Moran of ABC swung the pinata stick, saying I was in a tough spot, before derisively asking, "All of a sudden, you have respect for the sanctity of the criminal investigation?" Eventually, long after leaving the White House, I came to see that standing in front of the speeding press bus in those days had much more to do with protecting the president and White House from further political embarrassment than respecting the sanctity of the investigation. We would get to other topics that day, but reporters kept coming back to issue number one. The newscasts that evening were about as negative and biting as they could be. I could feel something fall out of me into the abyss as each reporter took a turn whacking me. It was my reputation crumbling away, bit by bit, and my affection for the job eventually followed it. I kept going through the motions, much as I had when my older brothers occasionally pounded me when we fought as kids, at least before I caught up with them in size and strength. I was unable to do a thing about it other than put on a brave face and refuse to let them know they had gotten the best of me. The briefing could not end soon enough. The ridicule I received that day and the following ones, though dispiriting and humiliating, was justified, given what I'd previously said. Since my hands were tied, about all I could do was go into a defensive crouch and stonewall. The post-briefing critique with my deputies was somber. They knew I'd been put in an impossible spot. "It is what it is," said one deputy, Trent Duffy, a constant source of candid advice. "Nothing you can do about it. You're in a tough spot." The other two, Dana Perino and NSC spokesman Fred Jones, expressed their sincere empathy for me personally. Back in my office later that afternoon, I received a phone call from Carl Rove. "I just want to say I'm sorry for what you're going through." Given the continuing investigation, I knew that was as full an apology as he would offer. It's clear to me Carl was only concerned about protecting himself from possible legal action and preventing his many critics from bringing him down. The network news coverage by White House correspondents that night was understandably unforgiving, harsh on the White House and on my credibility, which didn't help the president's either. Each played clips of my statements in the fall of 2003 and reported how they were now being contradicted. John Roberts summed it up. "It was a bad day at the White House. Unable to defend its own on-the-record statements, unable to explain why it repeatedly said with such certainty 21 months ago, now would appear so demonstrably false." Roberts' colleague, Bill Plant, concluded his report the following morning by saying, There are other people involved in this controversy over the outing of the CIA officer, but if Rove is truly not a target of the investigation, the White House at worst still looks stupid. That same morning, Carl ran the senior staff meeting in Andy's absence. Usually, I was the second one to speak, following a quick rundown of the president's public schedule for the day. Before Carl turned it over to me, he said for all our senior staff colleagues to hear that he was really sorry for what I was going through. Carl paused momentarily, looking at me intently, almost waiting for me to say, "Don't worry about it, no big deal." But all I could do was grimace expressionlessly, nod my head slightly, and acknowledge his remorse by softly uttering, "Thank you, appreciate it." The next day, I found a handwritten apology from Carl waiting on the chair in my office. Later that week, it would become known, confirmed anonymously by Carl's attorney, Robert Luskin, that Carl had been the second source for Novak's original column disclosing Plame's identity. Dick Stevenson, a White House correspondent, and his New York Times colleague David Johnston got the scoop for that Friday story. It was part of Carl's and Luskin's strategy. Carl's attorney insisted to reporters that he had not leaked or disclosed Plame's identity. Novak, according to Luskin, had said he'd heard Wilson's wife worked at the CIA, and Carl had responded, "I heard that too." And the Times article said the anonymous source, Luskin, discussed the matter in the belief that Mr. Rove was truthful in saying that he had not disclosed Miss Wilson's identity. The Times story said that Novak had described the two senior administration officials in a follow-on column published October 1, 2003. His primary source, who was yet to be revealed, was no partisan gunslinger, according to Novak, and the second official, Rove, had only confirmed that, "Oh, you know about it." At a press conference the following Monday, held with visiting Prime Minister Singh of India, the AP's Terry Hunt asked the president about Carl and the leak investigation. "Mr. President," Hunt said, "you said you don't want to talk about an ongoing investigation, so I'd like to ask you, regardless of whether a crime was committed, do you still intend to fire anyone found to be involved in the CIA leak case? And are you displeased that Carl Rove told a reporter that Ambassador Joe Wilson's wife worked for the agency on WMD issues?" "We have a serious ongoing investigation here," the president said. He then continued, "And it's being played out in the press, and I think it's best that people wait until the investigation is complete before you jump to conclusions. And I will do so as well. I don't know all the facts. I want to know all the facts. The best place for the facts to be done is by somebody who's spending time investigating it. I would like this to end as quickly as possible so we know the facts, and if someone committed a crime, they will no longer work in my administration." The last line was part of a strategy for the president to clarify the terms of firing. Dan Bartlett thought the president needed to have something to say to that very question we knew would come up, and that it was best to go ahead and redefine the terms of firing someone who might have been involved in the leak, specifically Carl. Feeling psychologically battered, I quietly went along with Dan's construct, barely objecting that it did not square with what the president had previously committed to do. The media played it up as a changed position, as we knew they would, but it was best to go ahead and do it sooner than later. I was disappointed to see the president backpedal, but I understood his motivation. The whole situation surrounding Carl, who still maintained he had never knowingly or intentionally leaked Plame's classified identity, was murky, at least as the president would have seen it, and Carl was a very important part of the president's team. One day around that time, I don't even remember how it came up, I recall Andy saying to me in private something about how staffers felt bad for me because I'd been left hanging out to dry, unable to defend myself, whereas other staffers felt the White House should vigorously defend Carl. I think Andy felt bad for the spot I had been put in, partly as a result of his call to me that first Saturday morning in October 2003. But the Rove revelations were not the last time my words and credibility would be undermined. 3 months later, the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Scooter Libby, who might have been specifically directed to exonerate, would be indicted by Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald for one count of obstruction of justice, two counts of making false statements to FBI agents, and two counts of perjury before the grand jury. It would be revealed at the time that in addition to Miller, he had spoken to Cooper, though not Novak, about Plame, contrary to my public assertions that he had assured me otherwise. It was also revealed that he had shared the classified information with my predecessor, Ari Fleischer, in an apparently successful effort to use him to leak the information to reporters. Fleischer later testified that he did not know the information was classified. Over the coming weeks and months, Carl was vigorously defended by the Republican National Committee, whose hand-picked chairman, Ken Mellman, had previously been Carl's top White House aide and my former colleague. Conservative pundits and opinion leaders joined in the defense, orchestrated in part through Carl's attorney, Mellman and Mark Carollo, the veteran spokesman Carl had personally hired to deal with the investigation. In the end, after several lengthy grand jury appearances, Carl escaped indictment. Reports indicated he had not revealed his discussion with Matt Cooper about Plame initially to the grand jury. Then, after his attorney, Robert Luskin, learned about it in casual conversation from another Time reporter, Rove reportedly threw himself on the mercy of the jury.